Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
You're not a cop, are you?
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Hey, fellow babies, it's Alan.
And Donna.
Welcome to a housekeeping episode of the WKRP cast. For more than 2 years now, we've been dropping a weekly hour or so of goofiness about WKRP into your podcast feed.
Sure, we like to laugh, but we've really tried to keep our information factual. We've spent a lot of time with Wikipedia, websites, and newspaper archives researching everything that has gone into WKRPcast. We've even managed to find some new information about this 40-year-old series.
Even though we were getting a lot of stuff right, we knew we had to be making some mistakes. Well, we were, and many of you listeners were kind enough to point them out. We didn't mind. We loved the feedback, and we wanted to get it as right as we possibly could. Your feedback and corrections meant we were able to make our information about the show that much better.
The problem was the timing. Since you guys aren't on our editorial board, you weren't able to provide your feedback until after the episode had dropped, which is why we came up with this episode of the podcast, my children. We call it
the WKRP Cast Misses and Messes Episode.
Anything we messed up, we've gathered together as many of your comments as we could find. We had them coming in on email, through Facebook Messenger, Facebook posts, and more. Once we decided to do a show like this, we started keeping track, but we're very sorry some things have been lost. In some cases, we know a comment was made, but we can't find the name of the commenter anywhere in the deep dark recesses of Facebook.
We'll be working chronologically for the most part. We're going to start with first season episodes and work our way forward. We hope to fill in with some new info and maybe explain some things that didn't make sense the first time around. So let's get into it. We're going all the way back to the prologue and the two-part pilot episode.
Howdy, I'm Andy Travis, the new program director.
Our prologue was a chance to introduce ourselves and explain why we were doing this and what we hope to do. We also introduced you to the regular cast members and talked about season-long or series-long kinds of things.
One of the things we discussed at length was the theme, both the open and close. We talked about Steve Carlisle singing it and how the rockin' close with the unintelligible lyrics came about. Nothing has evolved more throughout the 2 years of the podcast than what we know about those two pieces of music.
We talked to Janet Michaud Wells about the production of the WKRP themes. Janet is Tom Wells' widow, and she was a personal friend of Hugh Wilson's. Janet told us it wasn't really Hugh who wrote the Town to Town, Up and Down the Dial lyrics. At least she doesn't believe so. She said Hugh liked to think he wrote lyrics, but Tommy was most likely the one who actually wrote the opening theme lyrics. Janet said she has the sheet music from the WKRP theme framed and displayed in her house. It was a pretty big deal for Tom.
The closing theme came with even more questions. What we knew about it changed over our months of research and interviews. We read about the gibberish lyrics, but whose voice is that? Who are we hearing play guitar? According to Janet, most of what you're hearing in the closing is actually Jimmy Ellis. Jim worked for Tom at Doppler Studios in Atlanta. We found interviews with Ellis and articles about the closing theme, saying he wrote it and he's playing the guitar on it.
The lead line was intended to be a sax, but the sax guy got stuck in traffic or got a better offer. Either way, he didn't show for the session. We hear scattered nonsense lyrics as a fill-in for the missing sax line. The story about Hugh liking it as a joke is fairly well known. Janet asked Jim about some of the details for us. He confirmed the closing theme is his voice, and he wrote the closing theme music. He said the first few words are, "went to a bartender," but everything else after is nonsense. As for the guitar, Jim said most of it is him, but some of it is probably Tom Wells. Tommy was a great guitar player. Jim was pretty sure Tom threw in some overdub licks.
Once we got into the episodes, we started to establish some patterns for how a podcast episode would be set up. We had the Herb Tarlick fashion alert and Les Nessman bandage report in place from the beginning. Other features like Venus's vibrant threads and the line of the episode wouldn't come until later as we saw the need. Our earliest podcast scripts were outlines. We ad-libbed using the outline information for reference. This is why we and talk over each other in those early episodes. Also, there are a lot of obviously and definitely, which can get annoying. We moved to a more formal script later in order to move away from our ad-libbed vocal tics.
Early on, we commented about Les living with his mom. He doesn't. She lives in Dayton. Nobody said anything. The first time we really knew anybody was listening was when we had our first big miss. In Pilot Part 2, the character Wayne R. Coe mentions this is
the same battle-savvy bunch that shut down Bingo in Wapakoneta.
For the episode, we did check on Wapakoneta. We found out where it was and how far it was from Cincinnati, but that's where we stopped. The morning the podcast dropped, we had multiple comments on the Facebook page telling us Wapakoneta, Ohio is also the birthplace of first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong. So for what we're doing, that would be a huge miss.
Andy put up a KISS poster in his office during Pilot Part 1. This was to signal the big changeover to rock and roll. It was pointed out to us much later that WKRP never once played a KISS song on the air the entire 4 years of the series. Oops, big miss, which is why we're mentioning it here.
And of course, Pilot Part 1 was where I had my boneheaded deduction about Johnny's name while he was in L.A. Andy says,
Johnny Sunshine, I remember. Yeah, it was Los Angeles in the late 60s. Johnny Sunshine boss Jack.
Well, I decided this must be two different people. A morning team. Now, it's not. Johnny was calling himself Johnny Sunshine Boss Jock.
Johnny Sunshine Boss Jock.
On boss format stations like what Johnny was supposed to be on in L.A., it was common for the jocks to add boss to their name or refer to themselves as being boss.
Boss Jock.
Andy said it with a weird inflection, which was enough to cause me to jump the rails and go away with my goofy theory.
No huge problems in Less on a Ledge or Hoodlum Rock, at least none anyone reported to us.
Hello, we're the scum of the earth.
No.
Yes.
Huh?
Mm.
Hi.
Hoodlum Rock marked our first ever interview. We talked to Michael DeBar for about 10 minutes. Michael was very gracious to have taken the time to talk to us, but we had no clue what we were doing. Like most things involved with the podcast, we learned. Odd note about Hoodlum Rock, it's our shortest podcast at only 40 minutes, and that's with an interview. We don't think we left anything out, it's just short.
Yeah, these are the guys.
We discovered talking to people who had been on the show was just too much fun. We definitely wanted to do it again. We also saw a big jump in listener numbers when we included an interview. This is where a friend of the podcast, L.A. Jamie Schmidt, jumped in to help. Jamie knows people in Hollywood. He also knows how to contact people. Jamie started feeding us Facebook page and contact info on various guest stars who were still living. We then would stalk, harass, and annoy these poor people in an attempt to get them to talk to us.
We also learned about interview prep. Although it sounds like it, an interview isn't just having a conversation. We had notes when we talked to Michael, but they weren't thorough or enough. We started to write out questions in advance. Lots of questions. We asked Facebook page followers and patrons to load us up with questions for each new interview. We would go into later interviews with page after page of questions. Always having another question ready to go is the secret to a good interview.
Ultimately, we wound up interviewing more than 20 people involved with the production of the show. We talked primarily to guest stars, but also to writers, producer Max Tash, and our last interview we talked to Gary Sandy about his role as Andy Travis. A big thanks to WKRP Cast listener Tim Palgut, who has always been good about thanking whoever we interviewed on the Facebook page. Tim knows how to make our interview victims feel appreciated.
Which brings us to our second most downloaded episode, Hold Up.
Don't touch anything, Lois. It's very important. Don't touch the merchandise.
Somehow, Hold Up felt longer than 24 minutes. They packed a lot in, and we had a lot of laughs. Hold Up gave us Hamilton Camp, Bucky Dornster, Wingy Minone, and the immortal line...
Speed kills, Del.
Hold Up is the first episode where we really started feeling comfortable in the podcast format and where we really started to have some fun.
Moosey hockey.
We had a big miss in Hold Up. When Del does that pitch to Herb and says he wants to fill the hole in Herb's life with sound, the sound he played on the network airing was a clip from Van Halen. It's not on the Shout Factory disc, but we covered it on the podcast episode and we played a clip. What we missed was this. Van Halen's appearance on the episode Hold Up was their very first appearance of any kind on any TV show or movie soundtrack. They would go on to have more than 130 soundtrack credits, but their very first was right here on WKRP.
Next up is Bailey's show.
They can't all be crazy.
We had a miss on this one. We talked about Mr. Eisenhower, who was in a wheelchair. He waved some mini American flags as he was wheeled back to talk to Bailey.
Mr. Eisenhower?
We said he was not credited and didn't give a name. L.A. Jamie pointed out to us his name is Barry Kroger, and he's quite the veteran actor. Barry had 105 acting credits on his IMDb profile. This one on WKRP was his last. If we'd have looked a little more closely at the credits list on IMDb, we'd have seen Barry listed as uncredited. It was a whiff, a big miss. We were on the IMDb page, but missed this info. It was a good lesson. We started to check and double-check more systematically when going through our sources.
There was another miss in Bailey's show. We had some fun with Andy's very tight t-shirt promoting the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. What we didn't tell you was Gary Sandy has performed on stage at the CPP several times. He even did a support and fundraising message for the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park during the pandemic. Which brings us to Turkeys Away. We put a lot into our Turkeys Away episode, so no big misses or messes we know of. There is one thing we didn't talk about that I found interesting in our research. Live turkey tosses were actually more common than you might think in the 50s and 60s. We found info about them happening in Arkansas, Arizona, California, Kansas, and several other places, primarily in the South.
Some were radio station or newspaper stunts, but many were also community-sponsored events. Live turkeys would be thrown off the back of a pickup truck or sometimes released into a pen to be chased. With a lot of these events, if you caught a live turkey, you could turn it in for a frozen one. They didn't make you butcher your own bird.
I just have so many questions about one of those promos. It sounds
so
horrible.
So does ASPCA.
It sounds horrible. So after that was Love Returns. You may remember we savaged this one.
And
it was horrible. Yeah, it was pretty bad. We got more agreement than pushback. Some interesting notes about this one came out in our interview with Gary Sandy. Gary mentioned a scene at the end which was cut. In it, he said Andy Travis was supposed to be on the air filling in at the station. This is not uncommon for a program director to do, and we saw Andy do it during Family Affair. Andy dedicates the Little River Band song Reminiscing to his rock star girlfriend, Linda Taylor, as a way to tell her it's over. Gary thinks Howard Hessman had them nix this scene because Howard didn't want another DJ in the booth. Check our Gary Sandy interview for details.
Instead of getting his chance to shine in the studio, Andy instead goes for a walk through the park with Linda. He was wearing what he called the biggest cowboy hat in the world. Another great detail about this episode came out in our Max Tash interview. We found out the guy named Kim, Johnny's date with the DJ winner, was being played by Max.
And Johnny,
Kim.
Well, are you having a good time?
Yeah, we're having a wonderful time. We may go dancing later.
Since he doesn't speak, there was no on-screen credit. Also, Max is not listed as uncredited on IMDb. We think someone should get that updated as soon as possible.
After Love Returns, we had the long hiatus over the winter of 1978-79. This was when they added the bullpen to the list of available sets. The first episode back in January was Mama's Review with all new Mama, Carol Bruce.
Booga.
We've got kind of a mess in this one. In our bio of Carol Bruce, we talked about how she was discovered by legendary composer Irving Berlin. That's true.
We then told you Mr. Berlin wrote an entire musical for Carol Bruce. This is where we messed up. What he did was write a part for her into a new musical. He was working on 1940s Louisiana Purchase when he met Carol Bruce. He added in the part of Beatrice specifically for her. So still very cool, but not quite as cool as having Irving Berlin write an entire show for you. By the way, Louisiana Purchase had a run of 444 Broadway performances. It was also made into a 1941 movie starring Bob Hope. Donna Drake played Beatrice in the movie version.
Which brings us to the first real post-hiatus episode, A Date with Jennifer.
5-5-5, macho.
This Sanders Fairman script is hilarious. It also features a ton of pop culture and advertising references. We seem to have navigated it without any big mess-ups. Then after Date came Contest. The episode Contest Nobody Could Win was a huge one for the podcast. It included our interview with episode writer Casey Petrowski, and we had to break down both of the different endings.
With Contest, we were covering such a big amount of information, we feel like we kind of skimmed over a few things. The jumps back and forth between the two endings were sometimes confusing. We probably could have slated them better so you knew when we were changing from one to the other. If you know both versions of the episode, it helps.
Here's a weird one. When I'm talking about Jimi Hendrix in the original podcast release, that's not Jimi Hendrix who was doing the instrumental behind me. It was actually Stevie Ray Vaughan. I know I should have used the Hendrix, but Stevie Ray had a much longer instrumental section in his version of Little Wing, and it made editing much easier. I figured I could get away with it, but Stevie does have a distinctive guitar sound. Only two listeners have said anything, but I decided I really should change it. Now, if you go back and listen to the Contest episode of the podcast, you will hear Jimi Hendrix doing Little Wing, but for the first year and a half, it was Stevie Ray Vaughan.
During our bio on Leon Redbone, we mentioned he sang a duet with Zooey Deschanel at the end of the movie Elf. Well, Alan meant to say Zooey. He wound up saying something like Doughy.
And of course, he's the duet with Zooey Deschanel in 2003's Elf over the closing credits. So that's a little Leon Redbone.
This was at a time when we read the show like it was live. We didn't go back to fix things or do retakes. Later, as we got more comfortable with the production process, we decided there was no need to leave a mistake when we could easily go back and fix it. And you were wanting to geek out for a minute about editing tape?
Yeah, this feels kind of like a miss. When Venus and Johnny were in the production studio cutting up the songs for the contest, I mentioned they were editing with a guillotine editor. It's like what you'd buy at Radio Shack. The blade was on a swing arm. You swung it down kind of like a stapler, and you pushed until the blade cut through the tape. I mentioned how unprofessional those are, but I didn't explain why. You couldn't change the blade easily or often with a guillotine editor. Also, pushing to cut stretched the tape during the cut. You usually got a jagged, noisy splice with a guillotine editor. Professional tape editing was done on a splicing block. A splicing block's a machined piece of aluminum with a track down the middle that holds audio tape in place. Pros cut with a disposable single-edged razor blade. There are guides for the razor blade at the proper angles machined into the splicing block. I'd have boxes of blades with me for an edit session because it's important to change blades after every 3 or 4 cuts. A jagged cut means a noisy edit. The smoother the cut, the cleaner the edit. You can only get a clean cut with a very sharp blade, which is why I said those guillotine editors don't do a very professional job.
Okay, geek out over?
Yeah, I think so.
Ready to move on?
Yeah, let's go.
Next up, we head into Tornado, where we have a few things to discuss. We're very sorry about this. Tornado is the definitely and obviously episode.
Well, obviously.
We say each word about 100 times, and now that we've pointed it out, you won't be able to unhear it. Sorry. We'd been overusing both words to this point, but they really stand out in Tornado. It was shortly after this episode when we started to do more complete scripting to help avoid verbal tics like definitely. We also missed a chance to translate Art's Japanese. We translated Johnny's Spanish, but didn't go on to do the Japanese.
The accent may be off, but... Teowage! Kaso!
During Tornado, we laid some confusing statistics on you. At different points during the podcast, we claimed both Kansas and Texas have the most tornadoes in the United States. Both statements are kind of true. Texas has the most total tornadoes of any state. They get an average of about 150 a year. As a straight count of active tornadoes, Texas wins. Kansas gets about 90 per year. But here's the thing. Texas is huge. It's 3.2 times bigger than Kansas. Some of the information we were reading was accounting for the size difference, and we didn't realize it. If Kansas had the same tornado density, but it was the size of Texas, it would have about 290 tornadoes a year. So Kansas is far and away the most heavily tornadoed state.
Goodbye, Johnny, and Johnny Comes Back made up a somewhat loose two-parter. No real messes on either of these, but we did have a funny miss submitted. Someone, and we're very sorry, but we aren't sure who, suggested another cocaine nickname. We went through a fairly extensive list of cocaine aliases, but we missed one. We were told we should have mentioned Booger Sugar in honor of Johnny.
Booger!
Thank you, nameless person on Facebook, for that very funny addition to the list.
After I read that, I was kicking myself. How come we did not put Booger Sugar in on the list?
We then rolled right through Never Leave Me Lucille and I Want to Keep My Baby without any notable problems. Another big thanks to Danny Opendon and his mom, Lori, for her comments in I Want to Keep My Baby. Which brings us to our most downloaded podcast title, Commercial Break. This is the one with the Ferryman Funeral Home jingle.
Ferryman, ferryman, he's the man with the plot, the man with the plan. Ferryman, ferryman, he's the mortician man. A lot.
The cast spent a lot of time in a recording studio during this episode, and you were having some problems with how they were doing things, right?
Yeah, I felt like I missed a technical workshop opportunity. Having Johnny there as the studio announcer made for some really funny bits, but it would never happen that way. You'd never have the announcer cut their parts at the same time as the vocal song tracks. Jingles leave instrumental spaces where an announcer can be added later. They call these productions donuts. A standard donut means you get a sing-in, followed by an instrumental bed for the announcer to talk over, then a sing-out. That hole in the middle for the announcer is what makes it a donut. An example of a 30-second donut might be a 5-second sing-in, then 15 seconds of instrumental with an announcer message, and 10 seconds to sing out. A good donut makes a cool-sounding 30-second spot.
Jingles are produced in multiple configurations for both 30 and 60-second beds. They might vary the length of the sing-in or the sing-out. In some versions, maybe only have one or the other. A good jingle package might have 10 or 15 different configurations of the jingle. At one extreme is full sing. The other is full instrumental. When a station gets the tape of the jingles in from the ad agency or the jingle house, that's when the announcer parts get mixed in. Producing the jingle first without an announcer means the same jingle package can be used over and over to produce different messages or offers.
We were on a roll through the end of season one. No big mess ups, or at least nothing anyone caught in Who is Gordon Sims? I Do for Now, Young Master Carlson, Fish Story, or Preacher. Big thanks to Sparky Marcus Isolio for talking to us about Young Master Carlson and for Tom Cheehawk's comments on Gordon Sims and I Do.
Chips are falling.
On one of our Tom Cheehawk interviews, for some reason, I kept saying, we had to ask. I couldn't just say, we asked. I said, we had to ask, which annoyed me. I don't know if it bothered anybody else.
I would like to mention something about Tom Cheehawk. Tom contacted us in the fall of 2020, about the time we cut Hold Up. Friends had been sending him links to the show. One of the first things he told us was we were pronouncing his name wrong. Since I always list show personnel, I was the one who had to say his name each week. Alan and I kind of discussed it and decided to go with Cheehawk. You'll hear me say it that way throughout the first half of the first season. Tom told us it's supposed to be Cheehawk. He said the way to remember is he's not a hack, so it's not Cheehawk. It's subtle, but somewhere around Gordon Sims, you'll hear me change the way I say Tom's name. Sorry, Tom.
We got season two off to a strong start with the two-part For Love or Money. Then we came to the very different episode, Baseball. We had a big mess up on this one when it came to Bailey's cap. It had the word Nicolette across the front. I was thinking it was maybe some kind of designer. I couldn't come up with anything. Listener Brian Johnson, along with several others, wrote to tell us the cap Bailey was wearing had to be a reference to Nicolette Larson. She had a number 8 song in 1978 titled Lot of Love. We even heard it at the end of one of the versions of Contest Nobody Could Win. General consensus was this had to be Nicolette tour swag. We could never find this cap anywhere other than on Bailey's head, but we believe this has to be right. Thanks to Brian and everybody who commented on Bailey's Nicolette cap.
Next up is Les's catastrophic scooter accident in Bad Risk. Then we meet Steele Hawthorne in Jennifer Falls in Love. A big thanks to Thomas Calloway, who played Steele.
I like to think that a person's name says a lot about the type of person he is. What was your name again?
Tom is not in the podcast episode, but he did get back with us much later for an interview. His full interview is currently available to our Patreon subscribers. If you want to hear our full interview with Steele Hawthorne, go to our page at patreon.com/WKRPcast and become a patron.
I am thinking about editing some of Thomas's comments into the podcast episode, the way we've done with our other interviews. Be watching your podcast feed. If we do a re-edited version of Jennifer Falls in Love, we will post it as a new episode to the feed.
Next up was Carlson for President. The Richard Nixon references were thick in this one, and we missed a few. Art kept saying, that would be wrong.
Of course, we could use it. But that would be wrong.
Multiple listeners tipped us to the fact that this is a phrase Richard Nixon said several times on the Watergate tapes. We totally missed this one. Another, what we would consider tiny miss on this one, came during the debate. As Art says, come together, his hands move apart. And as he says, we move apart, he clasps his hands together. It's subtle, it's quick, but some listeners caught it, and we didn't.
Season 2 really had some great episodes. Coming out of Carlson for President, we went into Mike Fright, Patter of Little Feet, and Baby If You've Ever Wondered. For us, the big story out of these three was our Christian Seaborn interview. Christian played station attorney Elgar Neese in the episode Mike Fright.
You don't say anything, you don't do anything.
He was hilarious in the episode and full of great stories in our interview. In addition to his comments in the episode, we included his entire interview in the podcast feed. One of our goals with the podcast has always been to give you some new piece of information about WKRP in each episode. Christian was loaded with new info.
As our poster and background catches got more detailed, you guys also started dialing in on those awesome small details. Mike Malloy, a listener from Maine, caught this great detail in Bailey's Big Break. Mike says, and I quote, "Early in the episode, Johnny gambles his paycheck away to Herb, then spends the rest of the episode begging for money and food. When Johnny and Les are in the Air studio together, Johnny is holding a copy of the album Low Budget by the Kinks, one of my favorite bands, by the way. This seems like a detail you guys missed." Nice catch, Mike. Proof that no matter how closely you look at one of these episodes, there's always more to see.
No problems in the fluffy Jennifer's Home for Christmas. We did have another quick note from Mike Malloy about Sparky. Mike heard Donna mention the Tigers are a National League team when they've always been in the American League. Mike says, "I bet you get that one a lot." Actually, no. Mike and maybe one other listener are the only ones who mentioned it. I even know it's wrong, but I didn't hear it. This may be one we go back and re-edit. If you ever listen again to Sparky and we don't say the Tigers are in the National League, you can smile knowing we said it wrong for more than a year.
We had another great run of episodes from God Talks to Johnny through the Americanization of Ivan.
Communists don't kidding.
We were able to score another interview out of this batch thanks to Allison Argo, who played Andy's sister in Family Affair. She was kind enough to talk to us about her time on WKRP. She had a couple of great behind-the-scenes details to share, including how she wound up with all that hair.
Up next was Les's groupie. I caught a big miss in this one. In order to prep for our interview with Tom Dreesen, I reread the book Tim and Tom. I'd first read it over the summer before we started the show. After rereading it, I realized how much I'd either missed or forgotten. In Tim and Tom, Tim Reed talks about Venus wearing what looks like a Star of David in the episode Les's Groupie. We didn't know it at the time we did the episode, but we've since learned this is not a Star of David. It's actually the word love created on 6 points. It was designed for Tim by a jeweler who was a fan of the show. It created an international incident. When WKRP went into worldwide syndication, the country of Jordan refused to run this episode. They thought Tim was wearing a Star of David.
We had another great run of episodes from In Concert through Venus Rising. This group included the two-part Filthy Pictures episode.
I want you to move around the beach and frolic. Give me a lot of frolic.
A huge thanks to George Weiner, who played the sleazy photographer. George was kind enough to talk to us about the episode. You can catch his comments in part 2 of Filthy Pictures. To hear our full interview with George Weiner, visit patreon.com/WKRPcast and become a patron. We also picked up a great story about this episode from Gary Sandy during our interview with him. This is the episode where Lonnie Anderson refused to be in the same scene with Jan Smithers if they were both in swimsuits.
I'm not going to frolic.
Next was the award show where WKRP just missed being named Most Improved Station. In this episode, Andy is wearing a shirt with Wilmington College on it. We did a little history on Wilmington College, but we missed mentioning a very important fact about Wilmington. It's Gary Sandy's alma mater. We really should have mentioned that one. This might be one we need to go back and fix in the episode.
Wow, we're already to the start of season 3 and Airplane Show. This is the episode where Les is so fed up with not having a traffic helicopter, he hires a crop duster to fly him over Cincinnati. WPIG has a traffic copter, and it's driving Les crazy. In meetings with Carlson, Les mentions what he calls the copter gap a couple of times. We completely missed it. Thanks to listener Bob Quick for pointing out that copter gap is a reference to the Cold War term missile gap. When superpowers started to stockpile nuclear warheads in the 50s and 60s, the difference between what they had and what we had was referred to as the missile gap. Great catch, Bob, but this being Airplane Show, The copter gap line is still not all that funny.
Ooh, I've got one here about you, but I'd have said the same thing. There's a pennant in the bullpen with X-A-V-I-E-R on it. You got to talk about it in Jennifer Moves. This is what came in from listener Jonathan Strackman. Jonathan says, quote, love the podcast, but one thing I noticed in this and earlier episodes, Donna's pronunciation of X-A-V-I-E-R University. She pronounces it with the letter X as if it was spelled Xavier. I was always told the university is pronounced like a Z, Xavier. Do you know which is correct?
Nice catch, Jonathan, and a mess up for us. Multiple sources say it should be Xavier. Apparently, the name is Basque, and the original pronunciation going back centuries is Xavier. Xavier is an Americanization of the word. It also goes against the rule. Other words starting with X only use the Z sound, such as xylophone and xenophobia. One theory says that we say Xavier in the United States as Xavier because of the influence of the X-Men franchise from Marvel. The X-Men are led by Professor Charles Xavier.
Next up is Real Families, my favorite episode of the series and one of my favorite episodes of TV.
Well, let's go visit Grandma, huh?
Grandma's dead!
We mentioned this in the circumstantial evidence episode, but it's worth mentioning again. Tim Reed did not meet Daphne Maxwell on the set of this episode. He and Daphne already knew each other from Chicago in the 1970s. Tim had even been in a photo shoot with Daphne in 1972.
Tim and Daphne never got together in Chicago because they were both married at the time. In 1979, after her divorce, Daphne moved to L.A. Tim, also divorced by then, was already making a name for himself on WKRP. He met Daphne for drinks and convinced her to come on the show as an actress.
Herb, Elaine Parker speaking. Yeah. Is that a beer can on the night table?
What?
Isn't that a beer can on the night table?
I don't think so. I don't know what it is.
This was an entirely new option for Daphne. She was only looking for modeling jobs and had not even considered acting or doing TV appearances.
Starting with the episode The Baby, we rolled through six more episodes without any major misses or messes. At least nobody said anything. This group included WKRP blogger Roy Penny's favorite episode, Hotel Ocean View. We also got the very ambitious Christmas episode, Bah Humbug.
Now, braces, who's going to marry my daughter?
I will, Herb.
Ambitious was a hallmark of season three episodes, none more so than the next one we come to.
Daydreams. There was a lot going on in Daydreams with jumps in and out of the subconscious of each member of the gang. We got our first ever note from Glenn Stone about this episode. Glenn didn't find the podcast until later, but he's been making up for lost time. Glenn pointed out how each of the daydreams was triggered by the topics being discussed at that point in Art's speech. We had caught the connection, but we didn't say anything about it in the podcast. Probably a miss on our part, but we were also concerned about time with that one. We may have dumped it intentionally. Glenn will be back. He has a great catch coming up in 3 days of the condo.
We've got another interview available in Frog Story. Stacey Heather Tolkien, who was only 9 years old when she played Bunny Tarlick, was kind enough to talk to us about her time on both Real Families and Frog Story. This is another one where you might want to check the re-release. On September 6th of 2022, we ran the full Frog Story podcast episode with the complete Stacey interview in front of it. Make sure and check it out. We do have a note from Stephen B. Snell about something we said in Venus and the Man. Remember Murray, who worked for Onslaught Records, in the episode Johnny Comes Back?
Say hello to your new ratings booster, Mr. Doug Winter, courtesy of me, Murray Gressler, Onslaught Records. No strings attached. That's the way we work.
At the 3804 mark in Venus and the Man, Donna does a callback to Slaughter Records instead of Onslaught. This was entirely my mess up, Stephen. I didn't look it up. I tried to do it from memory while writing the script, and my brain mixed it all around. I remembered from our background that we did on the name that slot is the root word for slaughter. In my memory, somehow, Slaughter became the name of Murray's company. Good catch, Stephen. Stephen also has several good catches coming up.
Up next was the fantastic hour-long episode about Dr. Fever and Mr. Tide, featuring the incredible Howard Hessman.
My wink is my word, diggy-voo.
We broke the hour into two podcast episodes, stopping at the same point where they cut it for the two syndication episodes. No misses or messes from this one, but we were blowing glitter out of the editor for weeks after.
Then came Ask Jennifer. A note if you're doing a re-listen. We re-released this episode on May 31st of 2022. The re-release includes an interview we did with Eileen Barnett, the original Arlene. We put the full interview in front of the full podcast. The interview is only about 20 minutes. To be complete, if you're doing a re-listen, you might want to sub the version with the interview in for this episode-only version.
We also got a note in from Michael, the accountant of Rock Hernandez, about this one. Mike posts something almost every episode. He's always finding another poster or another album to list. His catch on Ask Jennifer is a good one. This is what he wrote. One of my favorite cases of obscure album spotting is on Jennifer's Last Day. The album below the Romantics poster is Tongue Twister by Shoes, which would have just been released when this episode was taped. Shoes is a power pop band from Zion, Illinois, and were contemporaries of Cheap Trick. It's your imagination. It's such a drag to waste it. The album and the one before it, Present Tense, are both power pop classics. Thanks, Mike. If you want to see all of Hernandez's submissions listing additional song or poster information, make sure to scroll down through our Facebook page at WKRPcast.
Bailey saves the Flim building in I Am Woman and Les gets a new dad in Secrets of Dayton Heights. In the Dayton Heights episode, we saw a giant poster promoting the Eagles live album. It's the one they put out after the band had technically broken up. I made the comment Glenn Frey and Don Henley's fighting had caused the band to split. Listener Chris Downing Starr wanted to clarify. He wrote to us, quote, "You mentioned a fight between Eagles' Don Henley and Glenn Frey during the poster spotlight. The actual fight was between Glenn and Don Felder, not Henley. It had been building for quite some time and came to a head after Felder allegedly snubbed a politician that Frey supported."
Chris is right. Although Frey and Henley had their differences, especially in later years, Henley would always refer to their fights as in the family or like brothers fighting. Don Felder was not an original member of the band, but he always was pushing for writing credit and to get his songs recorded. Felder's a fantastic guitar player. Don Felder and Joe Walsh deliver those blistering solos at the end of Hotel California. Felder is not much of a diplomat, and he might even be more than a little bit of a jerk. Felder and Frey had been at odds almost since Felder joined the band.
The night of July 31st, 1980, the Eagles were playing a fundraiser in Long Beach, California for Senator Alan Cranston. Frey, a huge supporter, thought Felder had insulted Cranston under his breath during a pre-show meet and greet. Felder claims he didn't say anything, but Frey confronted him. During the performance, a fight was brewing on stage. Between songs, Felder was taunting Frey, telling him, "Only three more songs till I kick your ass." Frey would respond with, "Great, I can't wait." After the show, no punches were thrown, but Felder did smash a guitar against a wall backstage and then sped away in his limo. They would not perform again together for 13 years. And we were talking about that sped away in his limo. So yes, he told the limo driver, go away quickly.
Yes, because I don't think he was driving the limo.
No.
We rolled on through out to lunch with Herb's drinking problem, a simple little wedding with Carmen's mama problem, and the almost shootout at the end of Nothing to Fear But.
No DJ has ever pointed a gun at me before. Not at any station I've ever worked.
We didn't seem to have any big mistakes. We were saving it up for a whopper until Debt Do Us Part. Till Debt was the episode where Hamilton Camp returned as Buddy Gravers, the fiancé of Johnny's ex.
What I'd like to do is take a tour of that receptionist, you know.
Jennifer?
Is that twin engine on the firing line or what?
Buddy's a pilot with a private charter service. When he first introduces himself, Buddy talks about taking everyone to Niagara Falls for a romantic getaway.
Of course, we had to do a little something on Niagara Falls. We mentioned the first honeymooners at Niagara Falls in 1801 included a young lady by the name of Theodosia Burr. She was the daughter of Aaron Burr, who we identified as being the future president. We are very impressed with the level of education of our WKRP cast listeners. Several folks caught it, including Stephen Snell, who wrote, quote, great work as always, but at the 47:22 mark, Donna said Aaron Burr was a future president. Burr did kill Alexander Hamilton, but neither man was ever president. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, so Aaron Burr was a future vice president, but he would never be president. Thanks also to Roy Penny, who sent us this note, quote, you know, they wrote a musical about it. Yeah, Roy, we heard. Thanks a lot.
What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton.
What makes that sting even more is the fact Roy's Canadian. Moving on. We finish off season three with a huge episode, Clean Up Radio Everywhere.
Imagine all the people sharing all the world. That sounds like communism to me.
This was the episode where we finally got Max Tash to speak to us. He'd been emailing prior to this, answering some of our questions, but Cure was Max's first writing credit. We told him he had to talk about it, and he did. Thank you so much, Max.
It was here where listener Glenn Stone almost scared us with the level of detail he's reviewing our episodes. Glenn mentioned we had the Billy Joel song Laura listed as coming out in 1972 when it actually came out in 1982 on the Nylon Curtain album. I didn't remember talking about this song. I started searching through the script to see where exactly we'd mentioned either Laura or Billy Joel. I couldn't find either one. I thought Glenn had made a mistake. Maybe he was referencing some other episode. Then it dawned on me. We did a montage of songs with bad words in them in this episode because of Dr. Bob Hollier's and his lists. In the show notes, I listed the songs we included in the montage. One of them was Laura, and sure enough, I had the date wrong. I have corrected it, and I want Glenn to proofread all of my show notes from now on.
The fourth season kicked off with the two-part Explosive Affair. We had a big miss in Explosive Affair Part 2 that we didn't realize until after the episode had dropped. This is another tidbit from the book Tim and Tom. Venus plays She's a Bad Mamma Jamma while he and Johnny are out at the transmitter.
Look at her, she's a bad mamma jamma.
We know both Howard Hesseman and Tim Reed programmed their own music, so this would have been a Tim selection. One of the CBS execs complained about the use of this song. They thought Venus was trying to slip in a coded reference to the phrase Mother Effer by saying Mamma Jamma. Although a lot of the lyrics from the day were references to something else, this one really wasn't. The KRP folks were eventually able to convince the exec it wasn't anything bad, and Venus was allowed to play it on the show.
We rolled on through the union, rumors, and Straight from the Heart. The unofficial part two of Straight from the Heart was Who's on First. In it, we talked about the Foreigner album 4 during the studio poster watch. We played a couple of the hits it produced. Roy Penny had a great tidbit about this album. He wrote, "The song Waiting for a Girl Like You holds the record for the longest time at number 2 without hitting number 1. What a great detail. Waiting for a Girl Like You wound up spending 10 weeks at number 2 in late 1981 and into the start of 1982. It was denied a number 1 spot mainly by Olivia Newton-John's monster hit, Physical.
So long, I've been looking too hard, I've been waiting too long. Sometimes I don't know what I will find.
Another bit of info about the posters and who's on first. We talked about the band Riot and their weird humanoid mascot with the baby seal head. We said his name was Tior, but that was about all the info we provided. We didn't mention Tior was created by the band's first record company, only they did it without consulting the band. The band loved the absurdity of the whole thing, so they decided to run with it. They even kept Tior as their mascot after moving to another label. Tior is an anagram of the band name Riot.
Next up is the hilarious 3 days of the condo. In the capper scene of Condo, Venus is telling the story of Johnny going to the condo offices. Johnny, you remember, implied that he and Venus were a gay couple who would be moving into the Gone with the Wind estates. In the capper, Venus says Johnny kept saying,
"Liza Minnelli this and Liza Minnelli that."
Yeah, we heard it, but it was the capper scene. It had been a long episode. We decided to let it slide. We did not do a bio on famed treasure and daughter of Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli. Our slight did not go unnoticed. We received the following letter.
Dear WKRPcast, a feature of your program is its in-depth discussion of every single minor musical artist to be mentioned or even slightly appear on WKRP in Cincinnati. For example, in last week's episode, you said, "The face on that half poster is John Oates," and proceeded to discuss the early 80s chart success of Hall & Oates for nearly 5 minutes. In your latest episode, you related the career of the Harmonic Cats for 3 minutes. However, when her name was mentioned twice in this latest episode, you gave no details on the life and career of Oscar and Tony winning icon Liza Minnelli. As Ms. Minnelli herself might say, "Oh, baby, no." Regards, a disgruntled patron. He didn't sign it, but we could tell from the email address our disgruntled patron was none other than Canadian WKRP blogger Roy Penny. Roy and his whole family, it turns out, are sincerely huge Liza Minnelli fans. We had greatly offended Roy. Alan handled the response.
Dear disgruntled patron, per your complaint regarding the non-bio on Liza Minnelli, when it comes to EGOT winners, the WKRP cast only recognizes 2, James Earl Jones and Barbra Streisand. Yes, it's true, Babs Tony is honorary. Our big problem with Liza, her Grammy is honorary. The Grammy has to have been a competitive win if we're going to take Ms. Minnelli seriously. We're also not happy with the whole, "my mom sang over the rainbow, so I'm a gay icon" attitude often displayed by Ms. Minnelli throughout her career. We may address the issue in our upcoming Missies and Messies episode. In the meantime, might we recommend a stream of Yentl? Sincerely, the WKRP cast. Roy forgave us a little bit when we did the feature on New York, New York and played Liza's version of it.
If I can make it there, I'd make it anywhere.
We also had another Glenn Stone submission about Condo, and it's a good one. Glenn wrote, "Early on in the episode, 3 days of the condo, when Johnny walks into Carlson's office, he is singing Nadine, Is It You? By Chuck Berry. Appropriate, since that is the name of the young lady who came in earlier. I expected to hear something about that tune, but I understand how it got left out with all the other things to talk about in this one. maybe you can add to the Mrs. and Mrs. wrap-up. Yes, we can. Wow, that was a total miss. Thanks, Glenn. Here's Johnny singing Chuck Berry from 3 Days of the Condo.
Nadine. Honey, is that you?
Oh, Nadine. Honey, is that you?
This might be one Hernandez needs to add to the Big Song spreadsheet.
The fourth season really seemed to fly by. We had a great time with Jennifer and the Will, Love, Exciting, and New, and especially the consultant.
Oh, Mr. Breezy.
We saved a huge miss for the episode You Can't Go Out of Town Again, where Art and Carmen go to their college reunion.
Hey, Moose!
We said the title had no reference. Oops. Again, we're very impressed with the literary prowess of our WKRP cast listeners. This title is actually a twist on the title of the Thomas Wolfe novel, You Can't Go Home Again. Wolfe was an American novelist who lived from 1900 to 1938. He was born in Asheville, North Carolina, and lived in Baltimore. This miss was mentioned by Philip Simpson, Patrick Ittyburn, Stephen Snell, and several others. Thanks, everybody, for the catch.
The fourth season continued to fly by with Jennifer and Johnny's charity, Pills and Changes. We can't say it enough, but another big thank you to Tom Dreesen for his interview and comments during Changes.
Hey, bro, what's happening?
Hey, blood, what it is?
Chris Fodor did provide us with some additional details and correction regarding a Changes poster watch. Chris writes, "Hey guys, I really enjoyed the Changes episode. Just wanted to mention a couple of corrections. Regarding the Neil Young Reactor album, there was a charting single from it. The track, Southern Pacific, made number 65 on the Hot 100 in early 1982, and the album itself peaked at number 27 on the Billboard 200 album chart."
Chris then pointed out a big miss that I take full responsibility for. He continues, "In the record library, while Sad Cafe is, in fact, an Eagles song, the poster here is for an English band called Sad Cafe, who made 7 albums between 1977 and 1989. They were led by singer Paul Young, who would go on to sing for Mike and the Mechanics." Way to bring the research, Chris. This one was entirely my fault. I'm a huge Eagles fan. I remembered Sad Cafe as an Eagles song title, so I wrote it into the description without looking anything up. If I'd Googled for 2 seconds, I probably would have caught that one. Thanks for keeping us on track, Chris Fodor. I also think Chris had some other corrections for us, but I have not been able to find them. Chris does some good work.
The fourth season continued without a miss or mess through Up and Down the Dial. There was a piece of music in this one we could not identify. Venus played it at the top of his show. Nobody had been able to figure out what it is, including Hernandez. We sent a note to Max Tash to see if he had any recollection. Max didn't know the song, but he said he did remember a lot of musicians hanging around on show nights. He said they were usually friends with the writers. One musician he said he remembers in particular is Tom Scott.
If you've been listening to the podcast, you might remember hearing the name Tom Scott. We've said it a lot. We even questioned why Tom Scott was getting so much coverage on WKRP. He had 3 different songs featured in the show from his Apple Juice Live album. It seemed a little weird for a session jazz sax player to get so much coverage with a niche album on a show about rock and roll. If Tom was hanging around the set and palling around with the writers, this would explain it.
We finished out the series with To Air Is Human and Impossible Dream. No reports of Mrs. or Mrs. yet, but those episodes are still pretty new. We'll keep an eye out for your corrections.
So this is going to wrap up our Mrs. and Messes episode. We do have some audio. Eric Paul Johnson, a friend of the podcast, a podcast host on his own, and just a modern Renaissance man, sent us his first memory of WKRP. Eric has been listening to the WKRP cast since we posted our trailer at the end of August in 2020. He was hesitant at first, but he gave it a shot, and he wound up staying with us through the entire 2-year odyssey. Here's EPJ.
I'll give you my first memory of WKRP. This is Eric Paul Johnson, by the way. Host of the wildly entertaining yet informative Face the Music, an Electric Light Orchestra song-by-song podcast. All right, that's out of the way. My very first memory of WKRP was that very first episode. I was there for it, man. That summer, I was 9 years old, and I thought, you know, I think I'd like to work in radio. I'd like to be a DJ. And then a few months later, a new TV show came on about working at a radio station. So, yeah, I tuned in, and I watched it for that very first episode. And the first thing you see is Jennifer. And I thought, oh, no, not another show with a dumb blonde. Haven't we had enough of Suzanne Summers' clones? The dumb blonde is so overdone. Ugh. Again, I was 9 at the time. But, you know, it's only a couple seconds in. I'll give it a chance. Maybe this dumb blonde thing will actually work. Maybe it'll work. And then she spoke. And she wasn't an idiot. And I was like, excellent. This is going to be original. We're not going to rehash elements of Three's Company for this show. And Andy came in and they started talking and it was funny. And then as the show went on, oh my God, this is hilarious. And then Fever was just a hoot. And then there in the background, Bailey.
Oh man, that does it for me.
I'm sold. I'm watching this show for the rest of my life. 9 years old, Bailey. And Bailey is still... she's the dreamiest.
Please forgive me, but the lady says to tell you that you're creeping her out.
Thanks for that, EPJ. Well, my children, things are running down, but don't unfollow us just yet. We plan to update and finish the Dr. Johnny Fever air check. When it's done, it will show up in the podcast feed. We've assembled a line of the episode supercut. We will also be posting it to the feed. At some point, we will be going into reruns. So keep listening. But for now...
that's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. You can find us on social media. And of course, follow our Facebook page at WKRP Cast. For more WKRP fun, you can still become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP Cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!